Learn to code, build apps, inspire the next generation.
Welcome to the Swift App School podcast, where we are empowering the next generation of app developers.
I'm Charles Long, co-founder of Swift App School.
And I'm Bob Williams, co-founder of Swift App School.
How's it going, Charles?
Good. How are you doing?
Doing all right. Liking this spring weather we've had lately. Nice, and feels like we're in San Francisco in the summer.
Yeah, hopefully we're done with winter. I mean, we've been in situations where we've had four seasons in 1 week. So
yeah.
I'm ready to move on to spring officially.
Yes, agreed. Well, today's episode is the ninth episode of Swift App School podcast. So we're excited to share some articles that we've read and then some work that we've done with Swift Playgrounds on the iPad. The first thing we're going to discuss will be teens earning more than their teachers and parents. It's an article that I found online, which was very interesting, of high school students who are already developing apps. And that all starts at places like Swift App School and our app camp in the summer. This summer is going to be July the 11th through the 15th. Next on the list, we've got an article. 45 years ago, Apple kickstarted the personal computer industry. Very interesting article and some of the comments I was reading. And it was interesting that Steve Wozniak actually commented on the article. So that was cool. And then we'll have something cool at the end, like always. So I'm going to start off just talking about this article. The headline is Israeli high-tech teens who earn more than their teachers and parents. And that caught my eye. And it's about app development, and high school students in Israel are working at startups part-time, and they're making $3,000 to $6,000 a month in U.S. dollars. So,
wow.
And they're just working part-time. One of the recruiters said they're young, they have a fresh way of thinking, they have fire in their eyes. That sounds familiar, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Sounds like some of our teacher assistants. And we have a couple working on some tutorials for us now. And sorry we can't pay them $3,000 a month, but maybe one day.
Yeah, if you guys are listening, don't get any ideas. We got to start small.
But yeah, it sure beats traditional babysitting and fast food grind that most teenagers are going through with their first jobs. But anyway, some of the students were saying, you know, but it wasn't about the money. It was actually they were getting a lot out of it, and they were even saying that they wouldn't need to be paid to do it. They enjoyed it so much. So that's what it's really about, and that's what we try to tell our students. You know, we've been in situations where we've been at conferences, and we just know that half the people there are just looking for a quick buck, and they're doing it for the wrong reasons, and you know, if you're just going to learn to code just because you want to make a bunch of money, then you should find something else to do because, you know, we'd prefer to teach students who are really interested and passionate about learning to code and being creative. And I tell people all the time that coding is very creative, and I just want to break down the stereotype that you have to be a math nerd to code because that's just not true. But anyway, I found this article very interesting, you know. One student said they learned coding in the ninth grade, and then right after that, they just kind of took off, and all of a sudden, when they're 11th grade, they have all these opportunities. So that's our hope for our app camp and for our tutorials once we have those online, that teenagers can start out, you know, 7th, 8th, 9th grade, and then by the time they're juniors and seniors in high school, they're able to make $3,000 to $6,000 a month. That would be nice. But even if they don't make that much money, they still have a resume they can build, and they have a career path set for them. So
I think this is a great opportunity for kids because you mentioned it's not about making money. I think the other misconception is that coding is extremely hard. And while it can be difficult, the most important thing is learning the lessons of perseverance. And yes. So that's why you can't go after money, because when coding does get difficult, you really need a mentor or someone with more experience to help you get through those tight spots. And it's easy to give up if, you know, if you're just chasing money, because you're like, oh, well, it's not worth it. I'm just going to move on to something else. It's easier. I'm going to play video games or whatever else. But I feel like once you overcome some of the obstacles in coding, you get really excited, especially if you do have someone to help you get through those. It's really difficult trying to figure it out on your own, but the people that have that mentorship and they can get through those complicated concepts, you know, for a person that's, you know, starting out in coding, all of a sudden they light on fire, and then they get really excited that, hey, I was able to overcome this obstacle, and now I'm able to build things that other people think is magic or some type of, you know, lost art or something. Like this, I think that's what's amazing to see, especially as you talk about when the kids that we have in our app camps, they get through a couple of projects and they feel like, okay, I can do this. This is really cool. So, yeah, this is amazing that kids are able to make this kind of money by learning early and getting that experience. So that's cool.
Yeah, I really thought it was interesting. And, you know, there was another, why do teachers not have the same salary as tech workers? And we're not going to get into that right now, but I do feel like sometimes our society has our values out of whack a bit.
Yeah. I think sometimes it's difficult to figure out how to value teaching experience because, you know, I've heard the old statement that if you can't do, you teach, which yeah. I don't like that statement.
Yeah.
Because obviously we can build our own apps. We could have left our day jobs and just become app developers. But to us, it was more important to give back and to teach younger people, to teach others that are going through what we went through when we started coding. And realize, okay, this is really difficult, and you're spending a lot of time just trying to understand the syntax, trying to understand the concepts. And for us, we felt it was more important to turn around and teach it. And so for teachers that are very experienced, I think they are worthy of the pay. Unfortunately, in the app development world, there's not a lot of people that are teaching. They're not teaching for money, I can tell you that. Most of them are in similar situations as we are, where we work in technical backgrounds or work in technical fields and want to do something bigger than ourselves and give back. So I feel like the payment, though, is like we mentioned, is not monetary. The payment is in seeing the kids' eyes light up and that they have this experience. And after a week of app camp, for instance, you can see them really excited, like, okay, I'm going to go make my own apps. I'm going to you know, build this thing. That's really exciting, especially since a lot of these kids have no coding experience at all when they come to us. Yeah. That's amazing. And that's what we get paid to. That's our payback is seeing them.
Yeah. And if they do have coding experience, they've maybe, you know, worked in Scratch or something like that. Real basic coding.
Roblox or whatever, or Python.
Yeah. But not a full scale app. So.
Right.
It is really just gratifying to see these students light up, like you said, and sometimes they become the teachers. We've seen that as well, which is really it's impressive at their age to see them working with someone maybe just a few years younger than them, and they're teaching them how to develop apps. So to me, that's the best part. I guess we could segue into talking about Swift Playgrounds on the iPad. Or is it Playgrounds or Swift Playgrounds?
I guess it's called Swift Playgrounds.
It is so different today than it was just a few years ago. I mean, when we started using it originally just on the Mac, now it's on the iPad. And now you can even upload your app from the iPad and publish it on the App Store. So it's really come a long way. We were kind of talking about, like, what was your name for it? Do you think at WWDC
Apple
will call it?
I think because it's so full feature now, they're going to change the name to Xcode Lite, and they're going to act like it's a new app.
Yeah.
But, I mean, even a year ago, this app has really improved because I really brushed it off when I first saw that they were going to allow you to make apps from Playgrounds. Because my initial thought was, well, that's not really Xcode, so I'm not even going to pay attention. But I opened it up and I tried one or two things and then I moved on. I went back to Xcode. But you had tried on your iPad and mentioned that you were impressed. And then I dove into it, I guess, 2 or 3 weeks ago when I saw a YouTube video of one person who's really diving in and developing his own game. And he initially started out developing a Swift UI app, and Swift UI being the new Apple user interface framework, which is a lot easier to develop for in terms of just writing a few lines of code and then you actually have something show up on screen. But SpriteKit has always been the game framework. So that allows for you to have, you know, your game aspects built right into your coding environment. So if you pull in SpriteKit, it allows you to pull graphics in and some other elements like being able to have physics and other things like that, the things that you need to build a game. This person on YouTube didn't realize that was actually inside of this Playgrounds app as well. So he like scrapped his project after the second video and went back and said, this is exciting. Let me show you how to build a game from the iPad and actually, you know, put it up on the App Store. So he's in that process right now. I'll put his link to his videos in the show notes. But I am impressed. After like two or three weeks, I have been using it, and every project that I can find that I've built with SwiftUI or SpriteKit, I've been recoding inside of Playgrounds, and everything works.
It's really cool. I'm actually flipping through it now. I'm discovering some things that I hadn't really noticed before. But, you know, like SF Symbols is built in. I knew about that. But then, you know, it has things that when you're on the Mac, you don't necessarily see. Like there's a tab that says what's new in SF Symbols, multicolor SF Symbols, things like that that are easy to find on the iPad that aren't so easy in Xcode or just, you know, you're maybe hunting around for a while. So
that's awesome.
It's really handy, and you know, it's got it in categories. Now it has it in categories on the Mac as well, but just that multicolor what's new, that's a pretty cool little tab where you can discover, because they keep adding. You know, it seems like every month or so they have a new version of.
Yeah, so I'm glad I did not download the paid version of the SF Symbols. So basically, when you're doing app development, there are times when you need icons at the bottom of your screen. So if you're building an app, like it needs a little person at the bottom, and maybe it needs a folder. Well, a lot of times you need to know vector art in order to create those, or you need to go online and find vector art. And by downloading SF Symbols, which stands for San Francisco, right? I think it's like a font.
Yeah, it's a font.
Sort of
San Francisco font.
Yeah. So SF Symbols is a collection of more than 2,500 icons. That way you don't even have to have like, oh, I need a send icon, a vector that I can put in my app. Well, you don't have to go find that on Google. You can just go to SF Symbols or what you just showed me on the iPad. You can just click in and type in what you need, and it already has a lot of them preset for you to use.
And you don't have to. The beauty of that is like if you're going to make your app an iPad app, a watch app, and you know it's going to resize all that for you in Swift UI. Whereas if you try to have custom art, then you're going to have to, you have the headache of having to resize for all these different screen sizes. Whereas, you know, without the custom, if you just use what they've given you, it's going to resize everything depending on what device you're on. So it just takes out a lot of that headache and extra work for designers. And, you know, in most cases, that's what you want to start with. I mean, you don't have to, you can always add custom art later. But it's a good way to start and show a client something that, you know, hey, this looks like it's really professional. And maybe they keep the, you know, the symbol art because they don't really care. Or they say, hey, this looks like what I'm familiar with. So in some cases, it's nice just to keep what they give you.
I also noticed that they have the dark mode icon. So if you need light mode or dark mode, both are there.
True. That's true. That's a very good point.
That saves you a lot of time.
Yeah, it does.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm very, very impressed. My initial response was, who cares about Playgrounds on the iPad? Now I'm like all in. It's also nice that this lowers the barrier to entry because initially we told people that you had to have a Mac or you had to have Mac Mini, some sort of Apple computer in order to develop apps. And now you can tell people all you need is a $300 iPad and there are low-cost keyboards that you can purchase on Amazon and as little as $60 up to, you know, Apple's is really expensive, but it's kind of the gold standard of keyboards on the iPad. But you can spend $60 and get a keyboard for your iPad and now you have a coding environment, which is, I think that was the issue before is, well, if you're not doing Mac development, you can just get a Chromebook and develop on that. Now you can use an iPad and you don't have to have a keyboard, but it's definitely recommended.
I mean, I guess you could, in the past, you could have used a Mac Mini, but, you know, you still have to buy a monitor and all that. So now you can spend, you know, $350 and you've got pretty much everything you need to get started. And, yeah, like you say, that breaks down the barriers. It's less expensive than it's ever been. And I think that's just going to continue to get more, you know, the prices will be more reasonable as things continue. But, you know, Apple's going to want you to continue to buy their products. So that's not going away anytime soon. As we mentioned in our last podcast, we're in debt because of all of our Apple purchases.
So 45 years ago, Apple kickstarted the personal computing industry. You might say Apple didn't release the first personal computer. What are you talking about? Well, if you look back at the history, Apple's credited for being the first successful personal computer. I'm going to read an article that talks about the Altair 8800, which was the first machine to bring computing to the people. But the Apple II was the first system even non-techies wanted. So there were computers out there used for business and for education, for military, for different reasons. But no one was truly marketing the computer for the personal home use. One reason why was because of the expense of the computer. On April 16, 1977, the first annual West Coast Computer Fair kicked off in San Francisco. At that event, which was attended by 12,750 people, Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak unveiled the Apple II personal computer. It's not hyperbole to say that the world has never been the same. Apple wasn't the first company to introduce a microcomputer, as it was referred to then, because of its use of a microprocessor, a $399 MITS or MITS Altair 8800 appeared on the cover of the January 1975 issue of Popular Electronics. Famously a non-working prototype, as the working one was lost in shipment to the magazine. It was a kit computer you had to assemble yourself unless you paid extra to MITS and were willing to wait. The Altair 8800 was sold out immediately, and other kits of its ilk, such as the MSI 8080, were hobbyist dreams realized, more than useful tools for regular people. They didn't come with keyboard displays or storage devices, much less ready-to-run software, but they put some of the power of a mainframe or mini computer on your desk, and you didn't have to share processing time with anyone else. So I look at the Altair 8800 to be sort of like a Raspberry Pi back in the day, where it's something cool that you could purchase and geek out over. Like, you got this thing that you can hook other devices to, like a big screen, or you can hook in your own keyboard and mouse. Because at that time, people started making accessories for these business class devices. So if you were a hobbyist, you could get one of these for $399, and you could attach your devices and basically make your own computer that you could just geek out on.
And that was a lot of money back then.
Oh, yeah, that was a lot of money. And you think about it now, you can buy a Raspberry Pi for like less than $30. Like less than, $20 to $30.
Yeah.
So it's pretty amazing to see how far this hobbyist world has evolved. But as far as Apple, Steve Wozniak, at the time, a young electrical engineer with experience working for HP and Atari, designed his own personal computer. He introduced the first prototype, barely more than a circuit board, and dubbed the Apple I at the local homebrew computer club in 1976. Soon he began hand-building units with the help of his friend Steve Jobs, whom he had met some years earlier and worked with at HP and Atari. Together, they sold Apple I systems to the enthusiastic clubgoers. They also sold about 50 of them to the local electronics store called the Byte Shop. So, arguably, Steve Wozniak knew how to develop electronics better than anyone else at the time. He could whittle a design down so it would use as few chips as possible, as evidenced by his work on Atari's hit 1976 coin-op Breakout.
I didn't realize he worked on that. I'd forgotten that. I thought that Pong was his first, but I guess Breakout was that before Pong?
I think Pong was first, and okay. He probably did work
probably
on Pong,
did Pong too,
while there. I think what they're saying here is that it was pretty evident of his capabilities of being able to whittle down these parts.
Yeah.
And Breakout was one of the basically coin-op games, because I think that was an arcade game.
Okay, got it.
So I think that's where they saw him able to, you know, efficiently build these smaller chips or take the parts and then consolidate down to smaller parts so they could build them and push them out to various places, and probably arcade centers or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
Soon, Wozniak and Jobs worked to develop a second model, one that could display not only text, but also real color graphics, as well as play sound and work with paddle controllers. A desktop machine that could play that breakout game at home, among other things. It would also have a built-in basic interpreter, a full keyboard, and expansion slots. Jobs ensured the system was packaged as a professional product you could use right out of the box, complete with an attractive plastic housing and internal power supply. And then, of course, the remainder of the article talks about the history of Apple II up through the Macintosh days. And I will say, as the article says, the rest is history. Obviously, we know how things turned out. And you know, the PC market, basically what happens, Apple challenged IBM, who was starting to catch on that the home market was actually something they needed to pay attention to, because at the time, they were international business machines. They weren't really concerned about home users. And when Apple challenged them and they saw that this was going to be a market, they really took a not a complete pivot, but they also opened up their computers to be basically cloned, and people weren't going to be sued by creating personal computer clones. And that's where, you know, Bill Gates and that whole story of the PC market started to come in, MS-DOS and those sort of things. A whole nother story for another day, but essentially that's where the Apple history began.
So for those kids out there who have no clue about any of this, I just want to say that when I was 9 years old, my first experience on a computer was an Apple II. It was in probably 1983-ish, that era. But I think, you know, our school had the Apple II. They didn't have the Apple IIe yet. When was it developed? Was it 83 that it came out? But we wouldn't have had that. We would have had the older Apple II, which had the floppy. And I think I had the Apple IIe in 7th and 8th grade. But, you know, we didn't have these machines at home. Most people did not own a computer, especially in my generation. Charles is a little younger than me, but in my generation, I only had a few friends who had PCs by the time they were in, you know, 9th, 10th grade. And I think I had a word processor and finally had a computer in my adult life in my 20s. But until then, it was just, you know, use the computer labs in college. And, you know, there were lots of them. And that was the way it was. And there really was no internet yet. And I remember being in college and saying, why do I need an email address? So, you know, times have changed. And I'm dating myself quite a bit. But, you know, there's a lot of technology out there that was not there back in these early times.
Yeah, you didn't know why you needed an email address. Now you have emails, Discord, Slack. What else do people have now?
I also remember in college saying, why do I need a cell phone? Somebody was trying to sell me a cell phone. I said, I don't need a cell phone.
Yeah, now people have all those things, including all the social media networks like Instagram, Facebook, Twitter, Snapchat, TikTok. Yep. Like the list goes on and on. And it's so funny now we say, you know, why do we need an email address? I remember when people back in the 90s used to ask me, what do I need a website for? Mm-hmm. Now, essentially, everybody has one with a Facebook or Instagram or
what
whatever.
What do I need social media for? I remember saying that, too. You know?
Yep. We've seen a lot of changes through the history of the tech world, and it's amazing to look at where we've progressed to at this point. I talked about it in earlier episodes of the podcast where I got my first computer. It was Apple II Plus. When I was 12 years old. But the only reason I received one was because my grandfather putting his money together with a coworker to help purchase that machine for me. But otherwise, we couldn't afford one. And so had that not happened, I wouldn't have had a computer that early. And then moving a few years later when I got a PC in my teenage years because my stepdad was wanting to create signs and he needed a computer to create these signs using CorelDRAW. At that time, that was mid-90s. So that computers were becoming commonplace in the mid-90s. But now you've got kids 5 years old with cell phones, 5 to 8. Mm-hmm. Not my kids. Oh, I'm the tech person, so I can't do it that early. Kids now have cell phones passed down from their parents, and some of them have social media accounts at under teenage years. It's crazy. How things have changed.
guess that moves us into the Something Really Cool segment.
Yeah, so Sal Khan, who's famously known for Khan Academy, a lot of people have used this site to supplement education in schools. He has a wonderful story of how he started Khan Academy by tutoring his cousins in math. And long story short, essentially Khan Academy was born because he thought, if my cousins are interested, maybe other people are interested in learning these things. And he built an amazing nonprofit business with topics from math all the way to physics and many other topics now. I think he's not the only person that are giving tutorials at this point. And so they have a great mission. I was watching a recent video where he's talking about a new nonprofit mission that he's working on called Schoolhouse.World. On their website, they state, "We are a nonprofit with the mission of connecting the world with free peer-to-peer tutoring." And it also says free online tutoring with students like you. And so I'll put a link in the description so you can follow it and watch the video. But basically, what he was talking about is what happened in 2020. In 2020, the Khan Academy team recognized that their traffic went through the roof, but they always knew that small group tutoring was highly effective. And so he started reaching out to some of his friends asking, couldn't we build a prototype of a platform where folks who need help in a topic could say they need help, and that other people, high-quality vetted tutors, could say, yes, I could run a small group tutoring sessions on that topic. And by the end of the summer, it was working. Now, it's funny because he says high-quality vetted tutors. Those tutors that are vetted, in some cases, are 13 and 14-year-olds, and they're helping people who are in their 50s try to get their high school diploma.
That's amazing.
Yeah, I mean, he's trying to flip education on his head, and 2020 taught us many things. It allowed for people, or actually it forced people, to become more tech knowledgeable with Zoom, and, I mean, for older people having to help, you know, their grandchildren, or parents having to help their children through virtual learning. I mean, it forced us all to kind of step it up. It also brought on work from home. So it changed the world, and I think it's going to change education. In his business here, he's saying, we're seeing people in very disparate conditions, economic strata, life stages, cultures being able to connect and empathize with each other around meaningful work that matters for both of them. We are seeing that it's actually possible to scale tutoring by leveraging people's willingness to do good for others. Great work.
Yeah, that's a great story.
I'm interested in seeing how far Schoolhouse.World advances, and I just thought that was really cool. So kudos, Sal Khan, on creating another great nonprofit business.
That's great. Maybe we can have Sal on the show sometime soon and hear more about it.
Yeah. It's hard to beat our last podcast guest. So that would be amazing if we could get him on and talk to him as well.
We're also looking for, if there are other app developers out there that want to talk about their story, we'd love to talk to you. We'd also really appreciate it if you could, if you enjoy this podcast, if you could like it on social media channels and Apple Podcast and other podcast platforms and give us a great review. That would be awesome, because the more reviews we have, the more people we reach. So we would appreciate that.
Thank you for listening to today's episode of the Swift App School podcast.
You can always find us online at swiftappschool.com, and we're also on social media at Swift App School on Twitter, Instagram, LinkedIn, YouTube, and Facebook. Bye, y'all.
Goodbye.